Welcome to Tea Smack, home of the Tea Smack. May I take your order?
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Talking Smack, where we talk superheroes, movies, animation, comics, and much, much more. I am your host, Josh Scar, and joining me, as most of the time, is my co-host, Alex. Alex, how you doing?
I'm fantastic. It has been a wonderful, brisk weekend, and I will tell you what. I was in a packed theater. I did not realize so many people were excited to see what sand looks like.
Shiny, glittery sand.
Yeah, Hayden Christensen was there. It was fantastic.
He hates sand. He notoriously hates sand.
I know, it's weird. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I mean, I could complain about some things, but for the most part, I'm good. Pretty good Sunday. Went and saw a movie and spent the day with the family, so can't complain. The wind today, I mean, if the recording just stops, like, we'll release the episode as we record it, little edits here and there as we do. It's because my power went out, because the wind is so strong that I keep getting power surges.
Are you perhaps under attack by the Freeman? Is this what's happening, Josh? Is that what's going on over there?
Shouldn't we be the Freeman? I mean, if I'm taking the political messaging from this movie correctly, we're the Freeman. And we're just pawns in a big, big game.
But we have water.
Isn't that the plot of Quantum of Solace?
Strawberry fields forever.
Oh, Gemma Arterton.
Yes.
We barely had a chance to know ye.
I guess you could understand that we are going to talk about Tune today, because if this movie was released early 2000s, I believe that's your joke, I'm stealing, Josh, it would be Toon.
Yeah, Toon. Or Toon. Yeah, Toon. But first, we're going to hear from J&K over at the Fuck My Whole Life podcast. They no longer focus strictly on work life, although the promo does still say work life. They now have encompassed the entire life, because everyone's entire life, unless you win the lottery, is pretty well fucked. So what better way to start your week than with J&K talking about just life throwing you shit after shit after shit, but putting it in a good spin. So let's hear from them and we'll be right back.
Work sucks. Am I right, Jay?
Yeah, Kay, it does. But luckily, the Fuck My Work Life podcast is here to help you through.
In this comedy podcast, we share memorable workplace stories through guests and listener submissions in the hopes of brightening your day, or at least leave you thinking, maybe you don't have it so bad after all.
Listen to Fuck My Work Life on your favorite podcast platform and follow us on all the socials at FMWLpod.
Spoiler warning ahead for Tune, also known as Dune Part 2. And we are back. We are here to talk Tune. First things first, Alex, we need to talk box office, because our movie's back. This had a pretty big opening considering what's been going on. Projected $81.5 million opening weekend domestically, $178.5 million globally, $97 with the international box office. It's already, practically 80% of the way to what the domestic box office was the original 2021 Dune, which still is pretty awesome considering that was a day and date release.
Mm-hmm. And it was 3 years ago when everyone was playing footsie with, do we release something? Do we not? Do we release something? Do we not? Can we bring people back before Tom Cruise allegedly saved the box office with Maverick?
How dare you praise him with saving cinema? He has done no such thing, allegedly.
And then last year was the Barbenheimer. So is this the Dunenheimer?
No, because it has no competition. I mean, this has to be another like Avatar sort of situation where it's a property people aren't familiar with, and it did well enough that people were willing to come back to it. It doesn't have the nostalgia factor. It's more, well, I mean, there's a nostalgia factor for people who have read the books and have a fondness for the 80s movie and the miniseries that came out in the early 2000s.
and just seeing what a proper budget for this story can do. So when we last left our, we'll say, protagonists, Paul Atreides had and his mother have survived an assassination attempt on his family, but his father died in the process. And Jabba the Hutt is trying to steal Tatooine from the Jawas, also known as the Freemen. And Alex, feel free to fill in the gaps.
Dune is about 800 to 900 pages. This is seriously, part two is literally just the second half of the book. It is, can't believe I'm making this comparison. It is what they were trying to do with Battlefield Earth. Because Battlefield Earth,
besides being a Scientology propaganda,
yeah, true, is a giant tome of a book that they just filmed the first part. So the first part of Battlefield Earth is, you know, is them trying to free from their oppressors. The second half is they learn to rule. But Dune is, I'm just shocked by how bold they were to not do a recap or anything. But did you notice that before they showed the WB logo, there was this odd, like, Freeman language, yes, on a dark screen with subtitles?
Whoever controls power controls whatever. Whoever controls spice controls power. Yeah, that was really odd.
Yeah, it was before the logos. It went that black screen, that with a little bit of music, and then it cut to WB and Legendary Pictures, and then dumped us right back into the action. So it's really hard to describe the second half of Dune without comparing it to the book. The book I haven't read in about 10 years or so, but they, for the most part, Lord of the Rings, this, it is broad strokes, it is moving people around the board, it gets mostly to the last bit of it, but there are characterizations I'm not comfortable with that I just don't know how they're going to finish their story arcs to go into Dune Part 3, because, yeah, to spoil things, this is a cliffhanger movie. Like, dear Lord, this is not an Empire Strikes Back kind of moment where it's like, we'll continue the battle. The last moments are seriously, shit, everyone's loading up, we're going to war. And that is just, I don't know how I feel. I don't know if it's a movie so much as you can review, so much as a movie you just get a mood from, if that makes sense.
I'm glad you said that it's a very Lord of the Rings-esque, because when Ricky and I got out of the theater, I said, this feels like the Two Towers to the Fellowship of the Ring to me, mm-hmm, because I love the Fellowship of the Rings. Like, I think that's my favorite of the trilogy for Lord of the Rings. I think it's like the most well put together movie. You get more character time. You get a lot of the world building. You understand how things are working. And then you get to the Two Towers and they're just like, you're in the shit now.
Yeah.
We're not spoon feeding you anything and we're going.
Yeah.
And that was Dune here, where it's just, Paul is now moving with the Freeman. We are picking up almost literally hours after the fight with Jamis at the end, mm-hmm, of Dune 1. And we're going to arrive at the Freeman colony, and we're going to give you a bunch of lore. We're going to give you a bunch of character stuff, but it's all building towards something. And this is like a 2-hour and 45-minute movie, which probably means closer to like 2 hours and 35 minutes of actual movie time, not including credits. And the first hour is just Paul learning the way of the Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really engaging for the most part, but it also needed something to break it up. And I get what they're trying to do. They're trying to establish a passage of time. But at a certain point, I was like, I need something else. I do not care this much about Paul and his mom going insane.
And that is, you're so right. I didn't actually pick up completely. It probably had been hours, and you're right. Because they have Janice's body, and they need to take the body to the Freeman kind of temples. Because on Dune, you do not waste any water. Like, those still suits that they wear, it's said that if you're wearing it, you lose, I think, a thimble full of water. And so people die and they have water in them. And so they will use and preserve that water as best they can. And if you die in some Ombra fashion, you end up going to the temple where they kind of add your water to the water of the ancestors. Or if you're a piece of crap Haderach, they are going to just take your body, drain it, and they're going to use it to power their still suits.
Yeah, and that opening sequence was pretty – it was really good. And, like, we're going to say it a lot here. Denis Villeneuve knows how to create a shot. He is
– yes.
He is what Zack Snyder dreams of being. Like, Zack Snyder can create a beautiful shot in, like, a still frame, but Denis Villeneuve can create a beautiful moment mm-hmm. within that shot. And in this opening sequence, we get the Haderach realizing that they're under an ambush, and random zero gravity suits happen, and just this beautiful sequence with almost no sound. They just start levitating up a mountain as they realize that a worm's being called, and the ambush continues. But it's a beautiful sequence, and Danny Villeneuve kind of got some shit leading up to this movie a couple weeks ago because he came out saying that TV is ruining cinema because TV is all talk where cinema is more visual, which, like, I took that more as the artist explaining his way of showing his art and like mm-hmm. the way he represents it to the public, and not necessarily him being like TV is ruining everyone's lives. The only real cinema or the only real storytelling is movies. Like I didn't take it that way, but it's the internet. So people kind of took it that way.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to interpret it as best as like as strictly as possible, he really was upset when they went to the talkies, you know, and Lucille Ball and that guy Ricky over there with inventing the reruns and the jibber jabber. How dare they?
That darn syndication.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the black and white, man. Cinema ended in 1928 when that first talkie was released. It's all about the music and the shots.
Cinema
sir.
Ended after the train came through the screen.
So the Harkonnens. Not Haderach. I don't know why I said that, but the Harkonnens.
Okay, I thought it was Harkonnens, but I'm trusting you since you read the books. You're leading me down a bad path.
I know, it's my fault.
You might as well be making me drink the blue Kool-Aid.
How dare you not drink the water of life? Those zero G suits. The first few shots of them, I hated them. I was like, this looks so unnatural, so bizarre. And then I realized that they are supposed to be representing the tech that Vladimir Harkonnen is using, you know, Stellan Skarsgård with that to get his mass around. I'm like, oh, right. It's the little symbols of the household that they kind of like string together of how people are. I'm like, yeah. Oh, that's what it, because I was just like, this is unnatural and kind of weird. I don't like that. But then it worked. Mm-hmm. You know, once I put those two together, it was like, all right.
I didn't even connect that. I was just like, okay, we have zero gravity suits, but I completely forgot that he has that enhancement on his spine that allows him to move because he's massive. And I, now that you mentioned, I'm like, okay, not necessarily so random zero gravity suits.
It is though. I mean, it is a little bit, but it works. And,
but we, through this movie, we also learned that the Harkonnens are not the brightest bulbs in the box. And we'll get into that in a minute.
Yes, because the Harkonnens, I don't remember ever actually visiting the world. So I have no idea if the world is like that black and white, dark sun thing.
That was so cool. That was just Denis Villeneuve showing off, if nothing else. And like their fireworks are just like splashes of water.
Yeah, against the sky. And or like whatever dome that they have surrounding their planet or something, it was very much the ink blot kind of just,
yeah,
it was, or like lovely
just solution hitting a slide in a microscope, like it just so cool and visually stunning, which again, it's Denis Villeneuve, so you might as well just it's a free space on your bingo card.
Yeah, so the crux of the story basically is Paul needs to learn how to be a freeman. So that's, and so what does he do? He teams up with the Freeman and they start just rampaging, sabotaging, going after anything to stop spice production, which poor Dave Bautista in the thankless role It's like same time. I kind of love that his role was he's an angry, sniveling, just sad sack of a man because he did this great thing. He took out, the Dukes. Leto. He crushed House Atreides, but he's got to make sure they're all gone because what if some of them got away and it's not successful? And so we pop over to the planet and we see this is where Elvis went to. There he is, the youngest nephew. And dear God, Elvis is a psychotic man as Freyd Ranthau.
I really have to say, like, yes, Austin Butler puts in a really good performance, although the ADR is very distracting. He does mm-hmm. a really good Stellan Skarsgård impression,
mm-hmm.
but it's very obviously ADR'd.
Yeah.
And I saw the day I went to go see it, which was Saturday, I saw one minor spoiler, which it's not even really a spoiler, but someone posted like, is it too early to talk about Austin Butler for best supporting actor for next year's Oscars?
Yes.
And after seeing this, I'm like, no, like you enjoyed this at performance. Okay. But no, that's not an Oscar worthy performance. That's not even Anthony Hopkins in 11 minutes of Silence of the Lambs worthy of an Oscar.
Okay, don't get me wrong. Austin Butler did fantastic with what he had. And I do like comparing Elvis to this. And he lost weight. He bulked up.
He bulked up. Yeah, he pulled a Christian Bale and just got massive.
Yeah, pulled the features in. But a lot of that sinisterness is the fact that they show him so much on that planet in the black and white.
And his teeth are like blacked out.
Yeah. And you see the hollows of his cheeks and you see like the bulbousness of his head and he looks so skeletal. And it was great. I did enjoy his scenes with Paul towards the end. But to me, it's just more, he's a sinister psycho villain. I mean, yeah. Even the Bene Gesserit, they just call it out. They're like, yeah, he's a psychopath, but we can work with this.
He's horny, so we can make it work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's just the internet just being the internet. So I needed to call that out because it's a good performance. Everyone puts in a good performance, which need in a movie like this. Mm-hmm. You can't have anyone being a weak link because all of a sudden it becomes absolutely ridiculous. And in this case, everyone brings their A game, which is what you need. But not every performance has to be award worthy.
No. I think that the director and the casting directors, they found the right actors to pull in the right performances. If I was to criticize really anything about the film, I would say that Princess Aurelian, played by
Florence Pugh,
is stuck in the same position that Zendaya was in the first film. Zendaya was, you know, part of the marketing, and she had maybe 7.5 minutes towards the end, mm-hmm. and then this became her movie. They tried to bookend this film by starting with that Princess Aurelian, that she's a historian primarily in the books. Yes, her role is that, but she likes to record the histories of the world. And so they have her narration at the beginning, kind of a little bit of a catch up into what's happening in the film. They have her kind of touch once or twice in the film, like, oh, remember this character? She's going to be important in the last 25 minutes kind of thing. But we don't get a real good sense of her other than she had maybe 4.5 scenes where she is finding her place as a political pawn.
And I think that's where this movie really falls short, because they're moving into a Game of Thrones style political ambition for control, but they don't set up the chessboard properly, because yes, we know she is the emperor's daughter, but if Paul ascends to a point where he can assassinate or overthrow the emperor, what good is Princess Aurelian? Creating a legitimate heir, I assume.
Yes, but I know he says he's writing part 3, but dear God, it's going to have to be parts 3 and 4. Because Dune Messiah is just as dense, and Dune Messiah,
from what I've seen, it's even more dense.
Yeah, it covers fairly quickly the first half, like 15 years of war, because the Holy War is a holy war.
Hmm.
And then like the back half is back to political machinations of now that these things have happened, but that's getting beyond this current movie.
So as someone who's read the books, let me, I have one nitpick and then I want to kind of get into the messaging of the movie essentially, but I have a big nitpick with this movie, which is at one point, Jabba the Hutt Harkonnen is like Baron Harkonnen, played by Stellan Skarsgård, is like
Vladimir.
He's talking to Dave Bautista's Duke-ness, and he's just like, "Hey, they're going south. Why aren't we going south? Why aren't we hunting this guy who's leading this guerrilla warfare against us?" And Dave Bautista is like, "We why would we go south? It's an uninhabitable. No one survives down south. Nothing happens down south." And they're just like, "Really? Okay." And then we cut to them riding worms going through the sandstorm, and there's a whole civilization in the south. And Paul is a good chunk of, like, two thirds of this movie is Paul refusing to go south because he knows that if he goes south, his destiny to become a messiah and to become emperor is going to kick off. And he doesn't want that. At least he projects that he doesn't want that. And my question is, they have spaceships. Why does a sandstorm in the equator stop them from going south? Like, it's the same problem I have with, like, Star Wars, where they're like, "Oh, there's a blockade. You couldn't go on the backside of the planet. You couldn't stay, like, in atmosphere and go out the back way." There's like weird little logic gaps that happen. And in this case, the idea that they have these machines that could go over the sandstorm instead of through it. Right. And they're like, "I didn't think of that. No, why would I do that?"
If I remember correctly, in the books, the Freemen do have a little bit of political agency in that. I don't think the movies talked about it. There is a space guild kind of thing. And the space guild is one of the other fighting factions that happens in there. They're the ones that kind of like are doing the trading for the houses and all that crap. And the Freemen trade spices with them. And in exchange for giving them like a fair price cut, the space guild has formed kind of like a non-blockade where they don't really focus on anything to the south. So there's like no satellites in that area. So it's a dead zone.
Okay.
But I don't know, but the movies didn't talk about that. And I don't ever remember there being a storm across the entire middle equator, because if the storm is so violent and horrible, how are they riding the worms through them on the surface?
Yeah, no, I don't get that either.
There is a little bit of oddity to it. I do, if I remember correctly, I think the worms mostly hang out in the northern side, because the two in theory, Dune planet Arrakis has a very simple elliptical spin in which it doesn't really tip at all. So I think that the poles are completely frozen and it doesn't bobble like the Earth does. It's just the moon is the suns are kind of located towards the top, and that is where the majority of the spice is
cooler.
Yeah, it's like a little bit cooler, but also they are hiding down there. But all the worms are at the north. I think that is what if I remember correctly. Either way, that is just a really weird oversight to like not be like, "Well, why don't we just send a spaceship down there?"
Yeah, it's either a really bad oversimplification where they've been the dukes of Dune Arrakis for generations.
Yeah.
And they just never bothered trying to go south for any reason whatsoever. The emperor never bothered. Like, I understand they're just there to harvest the spice, and that's what they're doing, and they're making money. But now that it's a pertinent issue, why are we not going south? Why are we not trying to find something south? Especially when you have a spaceship that could just go up and down in a couple of hours and be on the southern side of the sandstorm. I keep wanting to say snowstorm because we don't get sand up here.
But man, I really dug this movie. It hit a nice spot for me of I didn't feel the length of it. And it was in theory a fairly simple story with a lot of complex moving pieces. Mm-hmm. Paul learns the way of the Freeman, his hand gets forced, he has to see his future and become what is needed of him to reclaim his household, but also hopefully reclaim Arrakis for the Freemen. And it ends instead of in warfare, it ends in a duel.
I liked that a lot. I liked that they cut over so much of the battle. But let's talk about like the political aspects of this, because it feels very prescient for what's happening modernly. And that's where the movie kicks off with a lot of what's setting up with Paul and the Freeman is also that his mother, Jessica, who is a Bene Gesserit, a witch person, who has been declared that because of this prophecy, she also has to become the Reverend Mother of the Freeman. And they have to drink this blue Kool-Aid that kills them, but also brings them back to life, or they survive it somehow, which they say she can do like transmogrification, if I'm remembering the word properly.
Yeah, it's one of the Bene Gesserit powers.
So basically she just alters the poison once it enters her system and it's non-lethal for her. But she goes insane after that, which the movie doesn't fully explain how or why, other than the fact that it also clearly altered the fetus that is growing inside of her. They mentioned at the end of the first movie that she's pregnant, and now her baby growing inside of her is talking to her and having conversations with her and hearing all the stuff that's going on in the outside world as well.
Oh boy, that is...
She's moving the pieces on the board, whether or not Paul wants them to or not. And she's essentially forcing this prophecy to come to fruition because she has foresight now into what's happening. But it tips the scale for me, because at the end of the first movie, we're like, yeah, Paul, you go get revenge. You go do what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it becomes this weird religious holy war. And then it becomes icky. It's not as clean as a revenge story and freeing a planet. It's an uprising. I don't want to say the word, but it's an insurrection of the planet, let alone of the empire, and a coup d'etat. And Paul seems to like, the minute Paul takes the Kool-Aid, he just accepts that this is what we have to do. And it's, I don't know if it... Rephrasing. The movie doesn't do a good enough job of pivoting the perspective for me, because we're with Paul for the first hour. We're with him learning the ways of the Freeman, and then he drinks the Kool-Aid, and all of a sudden he's just like, I'm the Messiah now. I'm the guy who's going to free Arrakis from the Empire, and this vague prophecy that we've been talking about, I'm going to make it happen. But he does it in a way that is not benevolent. It's very forceful, and he's manipulating and taking advantage of these people that we have grown to respect and appreciate in the first hour of the movie, hour plus of the movie. And so for him to just latch on and be like, fine, you're going to worship me as a deity. You're going to go to war for me as your deity. And it shifts the perspective of, is he the good guy? Is he who we should be rooting for? We see the Harkonnens are brutal and awful, but we've also got someone here who's just like, you're my pawns now. You're going to war for me. I love you. I respect you, but I have shit to do and you're going to get me there. And it feels very selfish, and it's very weird to have that shift.
Oh, I completely understand where you're coming from. And that, I think, is a little bit of the failing of the film. The books have more time to be with everyone's internal monologue a little bit more. I will say one of the big changes that happened from the book to the film is that they've compressed the basically second half of Dune into maybe 8 months, when in reality it's like 10 years, something like that. Because in the books, Lady Jessica's daughter is born, and so Paul has a younger sister, and she is full on Bene Gesserit when she's born. Because of the changes in the spice, she has the full powers, and they basically say that she is an adult in a child's body, and she is incredibly creepy with her powers. Because imagine a toddler or like a 5-year old.
Imagine the baby from the last Twilight movies, but being able to, to act like a human.
Yeah, but acting like a human and then using the voice on people and having the prescience, you know, the farsight kind of thing that they have. also he and Chani had to have a child in the books that, spoiler alert, unfortunately, during one of the Harkin attacks upon the Freeman, is killed. And so that also is part of the driving force of Chani and Paul wanting to get this over with, is that now you've attacked us and you've killed our children. So that is something that also adds to some of the revenge that Paul does.
That's another thing that I don't feel like is emphasized enough, is the fact that we get 20 minutes of exposition about the Freeman and their beliefs. We see the well of souls, for lack of a better word, the well of water that they say, even if we were dying of thirst, we would not drink this water. It's essentially their burial ground, where they take the water of the Freeman and they put it in a well, and that is their holy place. And the very first time Elvis shows up on Arrakis, he just bombards their mountain that they're hiding in, and we see the destruction of that well, and the movie just kind of moves on from there. There's not a moment there's like post-attack horror where like people are injured, they're sad, they're crying, but there's never a moment where they linger with the fact that not only are people injured, but now this holy place where all these souls are, it's just gone. Like they have to start new. And that I think is a powerful concept if you do it properly. And the movie just is like, hey, here's that giant pool we showed you earlier that Rebecca Ferguson cried over before she went crazy. Sad, right?
So I will say that I did find it interesting that the way that they handled Aaliyah, which is what the daughter ends up being named, is by having her talk, basically communicate with Rebecca Ferguson. That is showing that the whole, like, she already in the womb is a full-on manifestation of the Bene Gesserit. Mm-hmm. It also kind of, I think, plays a little bit well because Paul has this, like, you know, like, he's always asking her, Lady Jessica, before she takes the water of life and becomes the Reverend Mother, that he's always like, how is she? Can you feel her? And stuff like that. Because they have such control over their bodies that, as is shown later on with Elvis, that the first time he sleeps with the Bene Gesserit, she's like, I am pregnant, and because you requested it, it is a girl.
Yeah, and they mentioned and foreshadowed that as well in the previous movie, where the High Mother is chastising Lady Jessica because she bared a boy when they allowed her to get married and live a monogamous life with Leto Atreides. She gets chastised because the one condition of letting her go was that she would bear only daughters to make sure that they didn't kick off this prophecy.
I do think that the second half needs about maybe 15 to 20 minutes more, because you'd said that, you know, he took the water of life and then it's like, go, go, go. I am the Messiah. I am going to lead you all to war and to free this planet. But I don't think they did enough explaining about what his visions are, and that what he is seeing in these visions of war and destruction that his mother's leading him to. And then in one of the final ones, his sister as an adult is leading him towards, it's called the golden path. It is a path that is the least destruction and the most protection of society. So you go to one way, if you like, you fully follow what the Bene Gesserit want, you're going to end up with a lot of war and hell. It's going to be horrific. And if you go this other way, well, it's the destruction of all the Freemen and some other stuff. But if you thread this needle in a certain path and you commit these some atrocities, it will eventually work out, which is still a horrible thing to think about, that you're left with all these options, this weight of the society upon your head. And you're like, okay, if I thread this needle just the right way, I will only lose maybe 70% of the people instead of 95%.
And that's something that I talked about last week when we were talking about Chainsaw Man, is that it feels like the message is kind of, you need to embrace the darkness to create a future that you potentially will never see, a better future that you'll never see, which I find funny, because Stellan Skarsgård is the guy who says that in Andor. I fight for a future that I'll never see.
The second half just needs a little bit of like 10, 15 moments, a little breath.
It needed just a little bit more to slow down and explain some stuff, because there is that moment where after he takes the Kool-Aid, he talks about how there's a path between certain choices that they leads them to victory, and he can see it. But we never get a clear picture from Paul that this is the Doctor Strange one out of 400 billion timelines situation, where like you said, we lose 7 out of 10 Freeman, but those 3 out of 10 are going to prosper once this is done.
Yeah.
And it's something that, again, it's not a benevolent thing, but give us hope, give us something that is letting us know that he's embracing the lesser of all the evil options. Like, he has no good options. The only options available to him to succeed are evil, and he's choosing the lesser of the evils that still allow him to succeed. I think that part is missing from Paul, because it just becomes him falling to his mother's side and continuing this religious manipulation of the Freeman just so he can ascend. And the movie doesn't do enough to explain how, why, other than he has a moment with Chani where he's like, with every breath in me, I will always love you.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, is that, for me at least, in that moment, I'm like, is he just being manipulative? Because that's all he's been since he took the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I don't particularly like that portion of it. They haven't officially announced it, but we're supposed to get part 3, which will be the first bit of Dune Messiah. And so much of it is Paul grappling with what he's done, and that in struggling to keep on the golden path, and what this all means for him, how this affects, and how it affects children. Jessica is still out there, fully on Reverend Mother, living, basically preaching that he is Mohab Deeb, and to continue to follow him and doing her manipulations. But before we get to like one of my complaints towards the end, which is a full on spoiler,
which we haven't been doing anyway.
Hans Zimmer, I hear people praising the score, and it was bothering the hell out of me.
When it takes a moment to do the gladiator thing and you get the like vocalization stuff, it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also just get the Batman, Christopher Nolan stuff, where it's just it's just tones. It's not music.
Right. The part that I actually love the most towards the end is, so full spoiler alerts at this point, he has to fight Elvis Presley. There was almost no music during that fight. They cut the score. It's just the two of them stabbing at each other. And you hear the grunts and the groans and like them mocking each other. You hear Lady Jessica, you see Chani, and the gas, the blood drip and stuff. I was like, okay, I'm like, thank you. Cause you know, this could have been loud. This could have been Hans Zimmer, like pushing like a little more trumpet, guys, just a little more. Ladies, get ready for the, okay, he's about to be stabbed.
He could have busted out a little bit of like Duel of the Fates or something, but it would have been overpowering.
But he didn't, and I really loved that.
I agree with that 100%. I think that was a moment where you needed silence to really emphasize the brutality of the fight. And one thing that even Ricky got lost at certain points, like she completely was just absorbed into the visuals of what was happening with Paul when he took the water of life, and when he has the revelation that they are Harkonnens as well as Atreides.
Mm-hmm.
She completely lost the fact that happened. She was too invested in like, what is happening with this weird child turning weirdly dark? Like, what's going on here? And she asked me in the car on the way home, she's like, how are they Harkonnens? Like, oh, she's the bastard daughter of Bene Gesserit and Jabba the Hutt. And so now she's also a part Atreides, which means Paul is part Harkonnen. So Paul is half Harkonnen, half Atreides, and he and Elvis are cousins.
And stab that cousin in the heart, man.
I think that is the logic hole in the whole, like, let's not talk about the Southern Hemisphere thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the conclusion to that fight is probably my biggest issue, because we see him holding the knife as Austin Butler's about to plunge it into his shoulder, and he's got the other one stuck like in his rib on his left side.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get the whole like off screen gunshot moment where we just hear the stab and they both fall to the ground and Austin Butler dies, because of course he does. He's holding the knife with his right hand. He would have to do this awkward grab with his left hand to get that knife out of his rib cage on his left side. If Austin Butler is as good of a warrior as he has been shown throughout this movie, he would have seen this awkward moment with his left hand going to get this thing out of his rib cage and then making the move to also get into his right side. And it happens too quickly.
Yeah. I'm willing to forgive that, in that Austin Butler has been fighting drugged people with his shield on in the arena, other than that one poor House Atreides person.
Lanville, the doctor, yeah.
Yeah, other than that. So I will kind of forgive that. I don't forgive the fake out of them keeping the camera tied up on the upper shoulders. And yes, you hear the stab and they're both kind of gasping for air and things. And it turns out like one's gasping because they're in pain. The other's gasping because they're dead.
Yeah. You know,
that I don't necessarily forgive.
I think that's that was too tropey of a moment for a movie like this that had held up really well on its own until that point.
Mm-hmm.
To try and give a fake out ending like that. This movie is above those things.
Yes, it is.
And I know I'm complaining a lot about these sort of things, and they're little nitpicks, because this is, like I said, this is the Two Towers of a modern sci-fi epic.
Yeah, it's glorious.
But it's a moment that is just unsatisfying at that point, at that juncture of the film, where this is the climactic moment between the good guy and the bad guy, or the purported good guy, the protagonist and the antagonist. And this is where Paul is going to ascend to becoming emperor, because they have made this agreement that Austin Butler's character, Fayed Rautha, is going to be the champion for the emperor, because the emperor is Christopher Walken. And he can barely stand, let alone make a duel.
Oh man, Christopher Walken. That's right. He was good in this. He had like 35 seconds of screen time, but he was good.
I was curious how he was going to, I mean, it's Christopher Walken. I haven't seen him in a serious role in a long time. And so I was really curious how they would get around his guys. I talk in threes.
Mm-hmm.
I go 1, 2, 3, 4. And yeah. So what they did was they gave him minimal line readings.
And you know what? It worked. There was a few line readings where it's like you can tell he's doing that. But I think it was more in the moment that he's doing it for effect of the whole.
They work around it, because, yeah, there's the moment where he's just like, daughter, how would you tell this story? So it's like, but they edit around it in a way that it doesn't come across that way. But the minute he talked, I was like, how are they doing this? How are they going to get around this? And I was paying very close attention to it, because I'm going to stab you in the face with a soldering iron guy is the emperor of the galaxy in the year 10,029, whatever. And in like the most dramatic sci-fi movie we've had since Arrival. And yeah, I mean, it's from the same guy, but it's just, this movie has no time for jokes and no time for lightheartedness. And how does a guy like Christopher Walken, who has made a career of no longer being taken seriously, be taken seriously in a movie like this?
So my last little nitpick, because I honestly love this movie. I plan on seeing it again this week. The way they choose to end the film is by putting a a chasm between Paul and Chani. Chani has basically been sidelined because Paul's like, hey, listen, I'm going to be emperor now. And Princess Aureline is like, cool, so we're getting married. He's like, done. And she takes off. Now, I do think that is a strong character moment for her, because she's just like, because she's all, I don't believe in the Messiah.
She's been betrayed too.
Yeah. I mean, and she's been betrayed because in front of everyone, he's just like, yeah, I know we've been, you know, but princess of the emperor. Now in the book, what happens there is Lady Jessica and Chani actually have a decent relationship. They kind of pushed hard on Lady Jessica being the sinister, fulfilling her version of the Bene Gesserit plan for the Messiah. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, that this character was supposed to, Paul was not supposed to be born. Paul was supposed to be a woman, and the Kozwit Haderach is supposed to be one generation further out. And that is supposed to be born to possibly Lady Jessica's daughter, or they're making the backup plans with Elvis Presley's daughter to fulfill this prophecy. Now, what happens is in the books, Lady Jessica is fulfilling her own version of it, but she is still kind of ambivalent as to whether or not she is a good or bad person. And Chani is aware, because Paul straight up tells her, this is what is going to have to happen, and you will be my official concubine. Now, I know that doesn't sound great, but in the books,
you get to be my side piece, side piece to the emperor. Not too bad.
Yeah. But in the books, Lady Jessica, I don't think they ever confirmed in the novel and the movie, but in the books, Lady Jessica is a concubine, and she is the concubine who has Leto's kids.
If I remember, because I watched the first one Saturday morning as well, just to refresh. It's the movie presents it as though she was a concubine, but they fell in love, and so she was permitted to marry Leto Atreides on the condition that she only have daughters if and when they conceived, and then she allowed herself to conceive a male.
Okay. I actually don't remember if that's how it happened in the book. It's been a while. But there is a moment towards the end where she talks to Chani about it, and she says, you don't understand, this will be a political marriage. She will never know his warmth, his love, or anything. And I think she even alludes, like, he's not even going to consummate it. He's like, you will bear the children. You will be, and history will know you as the wife, not the concubine. And Chani kind of goes, well, fine. You know, the whole, like, you know,
I can see why they made that change, though. That's like I was joking just a few seconds ago, like being the royal side piece is not necessarily the most empowering.
No, moment. No, it's not. Yeah.
So I think it is a bit more impactful for Paul to be like, I will be your husband. I will be the emperor because I will be your husband. And basically telling Chani, like, I love you, but this has to happen because politics and Game of Thrones, you know, we watch the old videos.
Yeah. It just, to me, by making that severe of a change of her not being aware beforehand and taking off, that does mean that there's going to be more conflict in the third movie versus the conflict necessarily just being straight up Princess Aurelian, like, okay, what the hell is happening here? Like, I thought we were married. I'm going to politicize this stuff. I'm having an heir and a spare, maybe a few more to secure this crap, dude. It's more like, I guess Paul's going to have to maybe go chase after Chani. I have questions, but that's just the thing I didn't like. I just didn't like that there was not that moment between Jessica and Chani in which they have a moment where they see each other eye to eye, and she expresses, hey, I've been through this, but you will at least be loved. That's what I'm missing.
I do think there's a way that, because the idea is you're humiliating the emperor.
Yeah.
So if you, again, make this movie 5-10 minutes longer, like what does it hurt where you have Paul explaining this stuff to Chani and just being like, this is all ceremonial. This means nothing to me, but it means everything to the galaxy or the empire. But you are the person that I want to be with. You are the person that I will be with, just not on paper and not in the recognition of the empire. And she doesn't care about any of that stuff anyway.
Right.
So you can make that work. But with the way they characterize Paul by in the last third of the movie, it doesn't quite fit with his character, or at least with the way they're presenting him. So it is kind of a, how do you balance it out? And I think with what they did with Paul, it makes sense, but it could have been done better, in my opinion, because it is a lot of political theater and it's Game of Thrones stuff that's not done with the same kind of panache that Game of Thrones did, where they acknowledge that, this person's betrothed to the firstborn daughter of this house and will take on their land. But no one gives a shit if they bear children.
Right.
As long as they're married on paper, we don't care.
Man, I really did love this film. I mean, like you said, we're just going over minor nitpicks about wondering what's ahead. So it took about 3 years to get this one.
And I mean, that's technically not even, because this was supposed to be out in October or November of 2023 and they pushed it.
Yeah.
Because Warner Brothers is like, we're losing enough money where we made enough money. Was it that they made enough money off of, they made enough money off of Barbie. And so they pushed it out to this year.
Man, I hope it's 2 years. I hope, because, you know, then that would mean 26, we would get Dune 3, 28, Dune 4 and wrap it up. I don't want the God Emperor of Doom, because that just gets weird.
Isn't there like a human slug hybrid in one of those?
Yep, Leto the second.
I saw an illustration of it on Twitter, because someone that I follow on Twitter, or I don't know how the algorithm works anymore. I don't even know if I'm following some of these people. Mm. Someone was like, I hope we get to this one because I want to see this, which I doubt we would get.
They would be leaning into some weird shit then. You're talking,
general audiences would hate it.
Okay, so this is part of the reason why you do not want to get into the weirdest of the stuff. It also stems from these books written in the 60s and 70s. So the Bene Gesserit, I forget what the heck their name is. It's like the Holy Mothers or something like that. But there's a faction that breaks off of them that challenges them. And they're essentially a group of women who have bred themselves so well that they are able to control men through sex, because it's so good they can kill them with it.
So it's Famke Janssen from GoldenEye.
Yeah. And so they're kind of like subjugating, but it's not just guys. They can do it to the Holy Mothers too. And it gets Janky. Weird. It gets pretty like, you know, were you just really into bondage in the latter half of your life? We're like, all right, kinky women who control you with their voice, not enough. We gotta go sadomasochism.
Well, I mean, if you look at the the costume design, there is clearly a fetish happening with some of these. I assume they take the descriptions from the books and adapt them, but there's clearly some kind of fetish happening in there.
Oh yeah. They're honored matries is what they are.
All right. Well, let's start wrapping up here, Alex. Tune. Is it a must see or a pass?
Oh, please must see, and try to see it two or three times, because we need it to make its budget back so the third one gets officially approved.
I will say it's a must see as well. I don't think I like it as much as the first one, because I appreciate the world building and the politics stuff being really well laid out. And in this one, it feels kind of like they're speed running it, but it doesn't mean that it's not good. And there's a lot of really good stuff in this, especially visually. The Harkonnen home planet, especially. I applaud Denis Villeneuve for the aesthetic choice that he made in making the Harkonnens look like the creators or the forerunners, whatever they were called in Prometheus, and just being like, I don't give a shit. This is what I want them to look like. This is how they look. And look, we're on a planet with a black sun, so the pink skinned people are going to look completely white, and it's going to be visually stunning, because that is my thing.
It's a great movie, and I hope they land it with parts 3 and 4. this could be an amazing series. Like, it would have been fantastic if they had been just filming these all back to back to back to back, and we got a Lord of the Rings 1 year thing. But if we get a Star Wars style every 2 to 3 years and quadrilogy, it's going to be great.
That's actually done well because they have a plan ahead of time.
I mean, they just got to follow the books.
So before we get going, before we start the outro stuff, got to remind everyone that we have episode 150 coming up, which is going to be our next Talking Smackdowns. And we are going to be giving away a Steam copy of Marvel Midnight Suns. And all you have to do to enter is to submit a fight suggestion. You can either do that by emailing us at tsmackpod@gmail.com, or you can use the hashtag Talking Smackdowns, SMACDOWNS. And we will take those fights. We will debate them. And at the end of the episode or in the middle of the episode, whatever it may be, we will do a wheel of names and someone will win. So don't forget to submit those suggestions. Email would probably be the best one, because sorting through social media, especially all the accounts we have, as you will hear, as you may know, if you regularly listen, is a pain in the ass. So emails will be the easiest way to get your name entered. We have a few entries at this point, hoping for more, because it's always more fun when more people are anticipating getting their name drawn. Episode 150, I believe, is scheduled to be out in early June. So I know we've got 3 months to go, but it's going to go by quick. So get those suggestions in, and maybe we'll do just like the ultimate Smackdowns and just speed run it. So this fight was suggested by this person. Who wins? Okay, we're not even going to talk about it anymore. Moving on. Whatever it may be, I don't know yet, but 150 is a big deal for us, so we're definitely going to be doing it then. Again, we appreciate everyone that has already submitted Smackdowns, but you can email us tsmackpod@gmail.com. SMAC is how you spell smack. So don't forget to enter. Alex, let everyone know about our Discord.
Our Discord is where you can find us, talk to us, let us know how we're mispronouncing fantasy names that, you know, don't have official pronunciation guides. Don't tell me about the Dune Encyclopedia. That doesn't count. That was after Herbert had passed away.
It's pronounced Elvis Presley.
Oh, dear Lord. And it's not Paul, it's Palud.
Not Atreides, it's Atrates. It's supposed to rhyme with atrocities.
But you really want to join, because you just want to tag Matt in anything and see what he'll come to fight you about.
So don't forget to join our Discord. You can find the link in our episode description. You can also email us at the aforementioned tsmackpod@gmail.com. Find us on social media of your choosing at Talking Smack Pod on Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, Hive Social, Post News, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Lonnie's website. Thank you to Leo Allen for these wonderful tunes you're hearing. Alex, who did the remix?
Howard Shore, because he was like, I can use less trumpet and make it just as memorable.
Thank you to Beppo for our original avatars, Retro Ale Studios for our Ricky avatars. Please like, subscribe, rate, review on your podcatcher of choice. And most importantly, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to listen to this. Alex, thank you so much for being here. Of course. Everyone, please take care. And watch Star Trek.
28 minutes of trailers for the IMAX version, dear God.
I actually can't hear you over the music. That's surprising.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. I'm just bitching about 28 minutes of trailers.
2 loves T-Smack?
I love T-Smack. Is it true? I do. Ooh.